This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 159 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we this week?
Great, David. Very good. And we have a guest this episode.
We do. And our listeners from Airplane Geeks might recognize him. He's a flight instructor, and we're going to talk about him getting his Part 107. We'd like to welcome back to the show Max Trescott.
Hi, this is Max from Mountain View.
I got to work that in. So we're kind of scattered about the country, aren't we? East Coast, West Coast, and something in between.
It's funny when you said a flight instructor, I'm sure people who listen to the Airplane Geeks were going, well, it's either Max or Rob. Oh, wait, this is about drones. It must be Max.
All right. Well, David, what does the show look like this episode?
We're going to talk about engineers intentionally crashing drones. We're going to talk about drones, lasers, and terrorism. We're going to talk about an AI program that helped drones fly over big crowds. But more importantly, we're going to talk about Part 107 and the knowledge test and Max's challenge about coming from flying real airplanes to flying UAVs. So, Max, thanks for being here. So I guess we should get started with the news. Well, our first story comes from engineering.com. Why are engineers intentionally crashing drones? Evidently, researchers at Johns Hopkins University, Whiting School of Engineering, have been testing consumer drones for vulnerabilities.
Well, this is some interesting work that they've been doing. And what they tried to do is see if they could find ways to bring the drones down. And they found that they could in, well, three different ways. First, they found that they could overload the drone's CPU with wireless connection requests. Just keep making a lot of wireless connection requests. That overloaded the drone's CPU and caused an uncontrolled landing, quote, uncontrolled landing. So I guess that's a crash, really. They could also crash the drone by sending it a really large data packet, which caused a buffer overflow. And if you're familiar with computer software, being able to force a buffer overflow is a great way to take something out or to take control of something. And they could do that with this drone. And then the third thing they tried is they started sending the drone false data packets from a PC. Packets that said, I'm the drone. And eventually the drone started believing, or the controller rather, started believing that it was the drone, lost communication with the drone. A drone says, I don't have a controller anymore, I'm going to land. So that was the result of that little experiment. So very, very revealing, I think.
You know, it would have been cheaper just to have us try to fly to things.
I guess we'd have crashed them, huh? Oh, dude.
How about you, Mr. Trescott? How do you fit into this? You actually are an accomplished multirotor pilot or yeah. Operator.
I spend virtually every weekend flying model aircraft. And I own a number of drones. I spend more time, frankly, with the model aircraft than I do with the drones. Just looking at the picture here, it looks to me like a Bebop drone. Now, they use Wi-Fi to connect, which not all drones use, you know, Wi-Fi. I'm just wondering if you know, those drones that are controlled by Wi-Fi are more susceptible to these kinds of exploits.
Yeah, perhaps. The article points out that these researchers are going to try to test for vulnerabilities in some more sophisticated UAVs, something a little bit beyond the consumer drone sort of thing. But the researcher that supervised this, Lanier Watkins, I think he hit it right on the head, hit the nail on the head when he said, quote, "You see it a lot with new technology. Security is often an afterthought. The value of our work is in showing that the technology in these drones is highly vulnerable to hackers." And I think that's true. I agree with him on sort of both counts, that engineers are usually concerned first and foremost with getting their idea to work and looking at ways to protect the device or protect the software from a malicious attack is usually a far later afterthought. And I think it's something that we really need to think about with all these unmanned vehicles, particularly as we start to see more and more enter the national airspace.
All right. Well, moving on. This is from one of our, can we say sister network and not get in trouble?
Sure.
Our sister network, Runway Girl Network. Drones, lasers is seen as key aviation terrorism threats. Well, we have talked about this a lot on Airplane Geeks. Drones flying near airplanes, lasers blinding cockpits. It's not surprising that they're considered terrorism threats. We actually had our first New Zealand incident occur that we heard from our Slack team. So it's not going to go away, is it?
No, unfortunately. This report is, I think, also revealing in that they identified three different terrorism threats to aviation. As David mentioned, lasers is one of them. Another is radicalized airport employees. That's a vulnerability. And the third was drones. And we'll put a link to this report in the show notes. But when they looked at the threat posed by drones, they mentioned a couple of things. One is, like you said, the proximity of drones to airliners and airports and the possibility, maybe, of one being able to take down an airplane. But they also found that there's evidence of terrorist websites that are actually advocating the use of drones with explosives to take out airplanes. And there are also reports, they note, of terrorists actually using drones for intelligence gathering in countries like Syria and Iraq and a number of others. So we like to talk about the good uses of drones on this show. But here's a couple of news items that indicate that, you know, there are some threats out there to keep our eyes on.
I got to say, I think it would be kind of almost comical watching a drone trying to catch an airliner.
Yeah,
I mean, not only would it not be able to match the speed, which means now you've got to be in front of it and, you know, be able to, you know, to hit it in midair. But, you know, what about the wake turbulence?
Yes. Just,
you know, when I'm flying airplanes, I'm worried about airliner wake turbulence. I can only imagine what airliner wake turbulence would do to a drone.
That's right. Yeah, I think that in the public's eye and maybe in the press sometimes, the potential threat to manned aircraft of small UAVs is maybe sometimes overstated. But perhaps one of the more dangerous aspects of a collision is, you know, if it hits the windscreen and you know, there's an issue there. But there's just not a lot of research in this area at this point in time.
Well, I can tell you from hand flying, you know, model aircraft, I've been, you know, watched people try to do a midair between two models. It's almost impossible. Because, you know, once they get a certain distance away, you lose the depth of perception as to what the distance is. And, you know, the distances are only going to be greater if you're trying to, you know, try and hit an airliner. Now, granted, it's a bigger target, but boy, this to me sounds like it would be much, much, much more difficult than most people would think.
And let's face it, of the other threats that are in here, lasers or man pads, man portable missiles, I'll take the lasers and the man pads over the drones. You know, there is a reason why that LL airliners have chafe and flare dispensers, because they're pretty sure that at some point someone's going to try to take a pot shot at one of their airlines flying into Israel. Everything's a threat, you know. This is a little bit of, shall we say, security theater again, but eventually one of these things is going to crash into an airliner and something's going to happen and then we'll be done with it that the first one's done with. But that's why we have a You're Grounded segment almost every week.
Yeah, and when that happens, I'm willing to bet it was not on purpose. You know, I'm willing to bet, you know, somebody was flying their drone in the wrong place and it was just, you know, a bad coincidence that that they hit, because I think it's going to be extremely hard to hit one on purpose.
Well, we also see some really positive research going on with this next story, David, artificial intelligence.
I like AI, and this was from Yahoo.com. Big data to drive contextual route planning for drones. What does that mean? It means using lots and lots of data to make sure the drones fly where they're supposed to via routes that are safe for them. I think big data is one of those things they really like talking about on our Slack team. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, we have some listeners, some team members there that are really kind of in that business to
field.
A certain extent. In that field, yes. Well, what we have here is an artificial intelligence company called Flock. And what they're trying to do is use this big data to drive what they call a contextual route planner for drones. So the idea is that this this AI platform, it tracks in real time things like position of people, of vehicles, of structures, weather systems that are developing, and a lot more. And then it seeks to calculate the safest possible flight paths for drones to fly through, well, congested environments like urban environments. If you imagine, for example, you know, an Amazon delivery drone, and it's got to get from this point A to point B, and there's a lot of different ways it could get there. You know, what if it had knowledge like this that could direct it across the safest path? So you need data to do this, lots of data. That's what big data is all about. And so there are a number of data streams that would feed this big data, things from telecom companies, from ad tech companies, things like that, that would feed this. So it's a very interesting concept.
Boy, I was just thinking of a data feed I hadn't thought about. What about tracking numbers of cell phones in a particular location? You could probably pretty easily figure out, you know, where people are concentrated or where they're not concentrated.
That's usually Aeroshell Square is where you lose all of your all of your phone signal in Oshkosh, right?
Yeah. Weren't you guys talking about cows recently? That's the first time I saw a cow was, I think Verizon and AT&T brought in a bunch of cows a few years ago. The, cellular on wheels, the big mobile units. So people can actually get a connection when there are too many people at the same big event at one time.
But if you're plotting a route for a drone, or if it's an autonomous drone, even better, that's deciding on its own route, and it has information like at this location over here, as you say, Max Trescott, there's an unusually large concentration of cell phones there. Well, that tells you that there's some event or some reunion or wedding or picnic or who knows what. That represents a concentration of people. And so, well, maybe let's go around that instead of right over it, just from a safety standpoint. I think this is really fascinating.
Or here's another scenario. You want the drone to stay over the sporting event with the minimal amount of people and not over the stands with the lots of people. So this way the aircraft can geofence away from the crowds watching the event and stay over the event.
So you're saying that drones will only crash into the visitor section of most stadiums then?
Yeah, the other team.
It's the other, right, exactly. Well, I was actually thinking about taking out the players, so
There you go.
Well, you're talking about, we're talking about drones over events. Another kind of event that we've been talking about a lot is drone racing, first-person view racing, that sort of thing. And we saw an article in the Times columnist, Canadian drone racer says sport better version of Formula One racing. Maybe that's pushing it.
Now, folks, I purposely put this in here because most people don't realize we have a diehard Formula One race fan on this show, and I just figured this would this was just clickbait for him.
So this is about a 26-year-old student who has actually, as I understand it, he left school His name is Andrew Mayer. He goes by May Day. But he's traveling around the world competing in drone races.
He's competed at the Canadian Nationals. He placed 10th at the U.S. Nationals in New York City, which was just a couple weeks ago. He's flown in South Korea, and he's entered in the World Championship in Hawaii. And I just want to throw that out there. If there are people who would like us to cover the Drone World Championships in Hawaii, let us know. We'll be happy to hop on an airplane to cover that for you.
Oh, wonderful. So, drone racing is obviously something that's growing significantly with the coverage from ESPN in the United States. That's added a lot to that. I think it still, from a spectator's point of view, still needs some development in terms of creating a compelling spectating experience. I think Formula One offers that. I don't think drone racing comes close to offering that at this point, but we'll see how it develops.
But here's, Max, here's something I want to ask you. And this was also part of the reason why I picked this story was, do you think drone racing will be like Formula One racing and will be the place where drones are developed better, faster, quicker in drone racing and carry over to the rest of the industry?
Yeah, you know the old saying in, well, I know it from auto racing, which is racing improves the breed. And that's where you get a lot of development. If you have the right kind of series that really encourages innovation and development, some series don't doesn't really do that, but many do, like Formula One does for the most part. And that's where a lot of interesting things get invented that can find their way into commercial use and even into consumer use. So, yeah, I think drone racing for that reason is a great thing.
I wonder, is drone racing better suited to a television coverage than to actually being there watching it live? I mean, you figure that they're so small, you're not really going to see that much if you're there live. Whereas in television, you can get the video feed from the racers themselves, so you have that first-person view, from multiple racers. I think that this is probably a made-for-TV event more so than a stadium event.
Yes, when I attended a drone racing event, I came to the conclusion that it was more about spending time amongst the racers, amongst the drone pilots, as opposed to when you watch auto racing, motorsports, you're interested in the vehicles primarily. But when you're watching drone racing, they're so small and they get so far away as they progress through the course that it's difficult to follow the drone and tell what, sometimes you just can't even see it. At least that was the one that I attended. And so I got more out of being amongst the guys with their goggles and trying to manipulate the controls. But that's not so compelling as the vehicles themselves, the aircraft, the drones. And so I think there's some work that needs to be done there to make it more popular. But maybe they'll find a completely different way to make it appealing to the audience. So interesting to watch.
I'm waiting for them to give FPV goggles to everybody, like you'd go see a 3D movie.
Yeah, half of them probably getting sick from the goggles. But okay, yeah.
Our next story actually was on behalf of our guest. Recreational drone use prohibited in local parks. This is from KenwoodPress.com. The Bay Area District of the State of California Department of Parks and Recreations has banned drones and other unmanned aircraft. Park officials are concerned about potential disturbances to wildlife, public safety issues, and negative impacts on other park patrons. Yet, Mr. Trescott, you fly at a local park, don't you?
Well, I try and fly under the radar, so.
Oh, but I'm bump crash.
You know, it's kind of funny. Just about 2 years ago this month, I went up to, I think it's Sears Point up near Richmond. One of the first times I went to watch some drones being flown, and a local fellow named Scott, who started one of the first national drone races out here in California last summer, had said, "Oh, let's all meet up here on this day," and it was great. There was a consultant from CNN who was talking about what they were doing, and a lot of people doing their drones, and of course, we wouldn't you know, park ranger comes along and says, sorry. I learned right then and there that one has to be careful about, you know, where they tell folks to come meet. It was a beautiful location right on the bay. So yeah, there are a few places where you can actually go out and do this. I like to go to Baylands Park, which is in Sunnyvale, right on the bay. And that's just a spectacular, nice, large park. Interestingly, it's within 5 miles of two very large airports. So who knows if they'll continue to allow that. But now on weekends, I'm usually down in Watsonville, California, next to the Monterey Bay. And we had a gentleman show up last week with his new Phantom 3, and he's had it for, I don't know, a month or two, and he's been driving all over the place trying to find where he could legally fly his drone. Mm. And so we let him fly it at the airfield there, and it was the first time since he's owned it that he's flown it, you know, outdoors. So it is kind of sad that, you know, things are getting more and more restrictive, and it is harder to find a place to fly a drone.
Well, on that, I think this is a perfect timing to talk about your transition from becoming a real pilot to, we'll cater to our other co-host, Rob Mark, to a drone operator. And Max, we've brought you on because you took the Part 107 knowledge test.
I passed.
So let's set this up. I think that most people listening to this are aware that effective August 29th, 2016, the new small drone rule for non-hobbyists that becomes effective. It's also known as Part 107. And under Part 107, the person flying a drone has to either have a remote pilot certificate with a small UAS rating or be directly supervised by someone who has that kind of a certificate. In order to qualify for that certificate, a couple of things. You must either pass an initial aeronautical knowledge test at an FAA-approved knowledge testing center, or if you have an existing Part 61 pilot license, but not a student license. If you're qualifying with that Part 61 pilot certificate, then you have to have completed a flight review in the previous 24 months and take an FAA UAS online training course. And so, Max T., that's the course that you just took.
Yes, indeed. So I'm sure everybody listening knows, of course, Part 107 only applies if you're doing this for hire. If you're a hobbyist, nope, no drone license required. Now, you have to register, obviously, if you have drones, but you as an operator don't need any type of license. So yes, for commercial purposes, you've outlined it perfectly. Part 61 refers to any of the pilot licenses that people would get to fly full-scale, large airplanes, Cessnas, and things like that. And if you're not a pilot, well, that knowledge test is probably going to cost you, I'm guessing, in the vicinity of $150, because that's what all the knowledge tests cost, pretty much, if you were taking one to become, a private pilot or commercial pilot or something like that. And those tests are still done in the same centers, operated by the same people, which, by the way, is to say, if you are a non-pilot and you're looking for one of these places, go to your local airport, go to a flight school there, and find out if they give the knowledge test. That's probably where you're going to be going after the 29th of August to take your online test. But for pilots, it's much simpler, it's less expensive, and there's an interesting array of questions that you end up answering. So in a space of under 2 hours, I went through all of the online course material that the FAA has, and most of that was about things that are different for flying UAS versus large airplanes. It doesn't go into all the information that people will have to study if they're not a pilot, things like airspace and weather and NOTAMs and TFRs, things that are just kind of common, normal things that all pilots are expected to know about. And then after doing the online course, I went and took the online exam, which is 35 questions. And most of those questions are identical to a sample, what they call the small sample exam with ACS codes, which is available at a FAA website that we'll post in the show notes. But let me just go ahead and give you a couple of these questions, because some of these are the ones that that I had to take on my online exam. These are typical. Any question that starts with who is responsible?
That's your clue, right?
The answer on those is always, almost always, pilot in command. I think I saw one that differed from that, but that's been true for all pilot licenses, you know, forever. You know, the answer is always you. The pilot in command is responsible for just about everything. Now, here is a really odd question. What does the line of latitude at Area 4 measure? So there's a figure, and you look at Area 4, and there's a line of latitude, and it's like, well, if you know what lines of latitudes are, you can answer the question without even looking at the figure. So that struck me as you know, a little odd. There were questions about weather that, again, struck me as kind of interesting. One had to do with stable cloud formations, which would be the stratus clouds that we have here all over California. You know, what kind of visibility, you know, would you have? And the answer is, oh, you know, poor visibility, as opposed to what would happen if you've got, you know, cumulus clouds. And the answer there was, oh, showery precipitation. These are the kinds of things. Actually, they were talking about stable air versus unstable air, but those relate to the kinds of clouds I was talking about. And that struck me as a little odd. You know, when people are flying their drone, I don't know that they need to worry whether it's poor visibility or showery precipitation. That's going to be pretty obvious to them as they try to maintain line of sight, which is, you know, absolutely required. They actually had a question in here for Rob Mark. I mean, who would have thought the FAA would be kind enough to write him a drone question? But I had this one on my test. What are the current conditions for Chicago Midway Airport?
And you had to really.
Absolutely. You had to read a METAR and determine whether it's A, B, or C. The sky is 700-foot overcast, 7,000-foot overcast, 700-foot overcast with either 11-mile visibility or 1.5-mile, you know, visibility. So you do have to interpret the METAR codes that, you know, pilots learn, you know, which seems kind of funny in this day and age because the METAR codes were, you know, created 50, 60 years ago in the days of teletype when, you know, it was hard to send lots of information. You know, these days we have wide bandwidth. It's easy to send, you know, simple English text explanations of this, but pilots are still expected to know the old, you know, standard METAR codes. And there was one question I remember I had to look up because I didn't know what the answer was. 107 gives all of the limitations under which pilots must fly, but you can actually apply for a waiver to waive any particular aspect of 107, and they wanted to know how many days in advance you should apply for the waiver if you were not going to follow the rules. The answer, people, was 90 days, just in case you're, you know, interested in that. So anyway, after taking the online test of 35 questions, I got my certificate, which I downloaded as a PDF here, and it basically says Certificate of Achievement certifies that Max Trescott has successfully completed the FAA Safety Team Aviation Learning Center online course, and the online course name Part 107, Small Unmanned Aircraft Systems, SUAS, and it's got the date. And now the next step is, how do I turn that into a license? And the answer is, on the 29th, pilots who have this certificate will go into a system they're probably already familiar with, which is called IACRA. That's India Alpha Charlie Romeo Alpha, IACRA.faa.gov. That's the system that all pilots have to use now if they are taking a check ride. And so you'll go into IACRA, you'll apply for your remote pilot operator license, you will type in the certificate number from the online course that I just described, and then you'll need it approved by either a flight instructor, any flight instructor like Rob Mark or myself, or, you know, anybody who teaches flying, a pilot examiner, or even an FAA inspector. The difference is, if you go to a flight instructor, they can't issue a temporary certificate on the spot, whereas you go to a pilot examiner, they can actually write out the temporary certificate for you on the spot, and you can immediately exercise your 107 privileges on August 29th. If a CFI approves it, you're probably going to have to wait a few weeks to get the plastic card that says you are a remote pilot. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Overall, how would you score, how would you rate the process that the FAA has created here?
You know, I think I'd give them at least a, you know, B plus. And the only reason I didn't score it as an A is because some of the questions seem kind of silly and not necessarily directly related to knowledge that, you know, a UAS operator would need. But I would say that the, you know, the online training course that they created, excellent, you know, really did a really nice job of succinctly going over, you know, the information you need to know. The questions, by and large, were pretty good. I should mention that for folks who are not pilots, you can take the, you know, the online training course, and you can take the same exam that, that I took. It just doesn't, you know, buy you anything other than an increase in your knowledge. It might give you a little bit of preparation for the knowledge exam you'll have to take, but that exam will be much broader in scope. It's going to include the information on, you know, TFRs and NOTAMs and contacting flight service and, you know, various other things that they didn't quiz pilots on because they know that they're supposed to already be familiar with that kind of information.
And David, the FAA was kind enough, I guess, to give us a video of the week on this topic.
They did. So, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's an introduction to the process and the test. And so it's not a pretty video of the week. It's not a stunning video of the week. And it doesn't have mammals or whales or anything like that. But it's probably one of the most important video of the weeks that we've ever done. So definitely go to our website, theuavdigest.com, and click on the YouTube link there from the FAA.
David, can I give you a sample question?
Okay, go ahead.
So, and I was looking for it. I don't have the exact wording here. But the question was, could a commercial operator who's got their remote pilot license here under Part 107, could they use it to drop, you know, free T-shirts over the audience at a concert?
The answer would be no.
What? Why not?
Because flights over people are not
ding 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 ding.
Not allowed.
You are you are correct. Excellent. Yep. And it was easy to get caught up on the first part, which is, are you allowed to drop free stuff? Well, sure. Just can't be over people when you do it.
Which is kind of pointless of dropping free stuff, isn't it?
You put it in the woods, somebody will find it.
All right. Hey, we've got a quick shout out before we close this episode. We want to mention the International Drone Expo, and we're a media partner for that event, the IDE. That's going to be held December 9th through 10th, 2016, at the Los Angeles Convention Center. IDE draws the big crowd, over 100 international exhibitors, more than 3,500 buyers from around the world, to this two-day event. There are exhibits. There's a large exhibit floor featuring a variety of drones and parts and services for all the different commercial applications. There's also a commercial drone conference hosted at IDE. And also this year, for the first time, they're going to have a drone racing event there. So if you'd like to learn more about that, take a look at the complete agenda. You can visit the website, which is www.internationaldroneexpo.com.
Or you can cheat and go to theuavdigest.com and click on the link there.
That's right. All right, so that'll bring this episode to a close. David mentions the theuavdigest.com is where you can find us. Show notes, and you've probably figured out the secret code by now, but show notes are at theuavdigest.com/159 for this episode. We'll have links to all the news stories we talked about, as well as the resources associated with Part 107 that Max Trescott talked about. And Max T, we want to thank you a lot for rushing home from whatever your activities were for today to get to speak with us on the show. Really appreciate it.
Oh, happy to be here. And yeah, those activities are, boy, flight training. I had the busiest summer. I'm just at the airport nonstop these days, but it's fun.
All right, David, where can folks find us in social media?
Well, the first place we'd like to find you is part of our Slack listener team. So go to theuavdigest.com/team, and you can join our little private conversations on big data and drones and Part 107. It's a really good community. You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. And this week, I'd love for you to go to our Twitter page, which is at UAV Digest, and there'll be a survey on what you want to call yourselves. Are you a pilot or are you an operator or a third choice just for humor's sake? You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. You can always reach us at feedback@theUAVDigest.com. Or, of course, if you want specifically to talk to Max or I, it's David@theUAVDigest.com or Max@theUAVDigest.com. We'd love for you to leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher.com or Google Play. And of course, if you'd like to become a patron of the show, you can go to patreon.com. Or if you want some swag, you can go to our Cafe Press store. And of course, all of those links are available on our website at theuavdigest.com. So now that that's all done and the business is taken care of, we again like to thank our fellow co-host from Airplane Geeks, Max Trescott, for being on the show. Max, thanks for being here. Where can we find you online?
Oh, you know what? Even better than that, let's tell folks who are flying drones and are looking for places to do it where to go in the Bay Area. Go to bayrc.net or go to rcbees, that's rcbees.org, and those are a couple of places where I hang out and fly my planes and drones.
That's awesome. We'll have the links to those in the show notes. So I guess with that, we'll say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
And Max in Mountain View.
Thanks for listening.